This sounds like art.
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 Art and his take on it.
I'm an artist of liberation.
Everybody wants to be an artist.
Art history.
Art history.
The making of art.
Art history with Lorraine Kipiotis.
Well, who amongst you has been to Sicily in Italy? Have a listen to this. Sicily is the gem of the century. Its beauties of nature, its collectivity of buildings, the remoteness of its past make it a country really unique. It does sound a bit like a blurb from a travel guide, doesn't it? Well, you would be right, but not a contemporary one. Those words were written in 1154 by a guy named Al-Andrisi. He was the geographer of the first king of Sicily, Roger II. Roger was a Norman. He had descended from Vikings, and for most of the 12th century, I wonder if you know this, it was the Vikings who were ruling the island of Sicily. Roger's rule heralded an era of opulence. He had beautiful churches built. Their mosaics are just incredible. They were built in and around Palermo. So here to tell you more about how a Viking found his way to the Mediterranean and enabled one of the most fascinating eras of Sicilian history, the Arab-Norman period, our regular art historian, Dr. Lorraine Kipiotis from the National Art School is here. Hello, Lorraine.
Hi, Suzanne. Good to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk about Sicily. Those mosaics left behind from this era, I've been there and they're some of the most stunning I have ever seen. I think you would agree.
Absolutely, absolutely. Those mosaics, you know, when you walk into those churches and you're just completely surrounded by them, it's just another world.
Yeah. So let's talk about Al-Andrisi. He was the guy who wrote the travel blurb. Was he actually writing a 12th century travel guide?
Well, yeah, in a way, yes, he was. He was really widely travelled. He was born over near the Straits of Gibraltar because if you remember the Moors, the Arabs had taken over, come across from North Africa into the Spanish Peninsula and had also ruled Sicily for about three centuries before the Normans got there. And so he was very well educated at the university in Cordoba, you know, modern-day Spain, which was at the time one of the preeminent institutions, if not the preeminent institution in Europe. And he had settled in Palermo. He was a little bit younger than the king, King Roger. And Roger would actually commission travellers to bring back information and then get Idrisi to write it all up. So Idrisi compiles it all together and he all of his vast knowledge and that of all the other travellers. And he writes a book called The Book of Roger, dedicates it to Roger, obviously. But it's otherwise known as A Diversion for Those Eager to Travel in the World. AKA, you know, a guidebook.
Oh, how wonderful. So what else does Idrisi say about Sicily?
Oh, well, he goes on to give the reader pretty much a description of Sicily as it is today. An island of momentous events with vast regions, numerous towns, infinite beauties and attractions, so that if we were trying to calculate its merits separately and to talk about its conditions town by town, we would find ourselves facing a task not only complicated but unimaginable. Now, this actually tells me a couple of things, Suzanne. It's that, first of all, the calibre of scholars that King Roger was attracting to Sicily, but also that Sicily in the 12th century was a major tourist destination.
Mm. So why was Sicily such a hot tourist attraction, though? What made it such a vibrant centre in the Mediterranean at this time?
Yeah, good question, good question. Because we're talking 12th century. So at the time, it was really functioning as a bridge across the Mediterranean and really a mecca for power brokers. Because, you know, if you think about where Sicily is situated, it's almost smack bang in the middle of the Mediterranean. You've got access to everywhere. And so Sicily continuously attracted settlers and conquerors, but also encouraged trade, travel, commerce, as well as substantial artistic interaction throughout the region. So, you know, if you start to peel back the layers, you discover that there's, well, over 2,500 years of history. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty solid there. If you go back past the Normans, past the Vikings, going backwards, basically the Arabs captured the island in around 831 and it had been for three centuries under the rule of the Byzantine Empire, who ruled it basically from Constantinople over in modern-day Turkey since the 6th century. And they had won it back from the barbarians, the so-called barbarians, the Ostrogoths and the Vandals, who'd invaded after the Roman Empire went down the tube, and they'd ruled Sicily for centuries after they defeated the Greeks, who had taken over from the Phoenicians that became known as the Carthaginians.
Oh my goodness, it just goes back and back and back.
Yeah.
Okay, and so by the time the Normans got there, Sicily was really rich, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was incredible. It was known at the time, the Arabs had actually named Sicily Balad es Sicilia, became its name. And they actually named it after one of the indigenous peoples that lived in Sicily at the time, the Sicels or the Sicels. And it was already one of the most prosperous regions of Europe. And Palermo, in fact, had become probably the wealthiest Mediterranean commercial port and a very important cosmopolitan centre. I mean, at the time, you know, there are reports that it rivaled Cordoba, which was almost, I think, the capital of, you know, Moorish Spain at the time, Andalusia, and Cairo. So, you know, quite the city to be in.
Mm. We're doing art history tonight. It's a little bit more history than art, perhaps. We're talking about the Vikings in Sicily. And to do that with us, I've got Dr. Lorraine Kipiotis with us from the National Art School. You're off shortly to actually lead a tour in Sicily, aren't you?
That's right. I'm actually going to go and visit all these incredible sites and churches and get to talk more about the Vikings and how they became kings of Sicily.
Now, it's funny. When you think Vikings, you think the Nordic countries. You might think the Viking invasions of England. You might think the Normans who had come from Viking stock and their invasion of England. But you don't usually think Vikings in Sicily. The two seem kind of paradoxical.
No. I mean, you know, when you normally think Vikings, you think, you know, tall, big, beefy, blonde guys who, you know, are pillaging and roaming all over Europe, and which they did. I mean, they travelled all over Europe. But this particular set of, I'm going to call them Vikings, so we need to step back a bit and have a look at that family tree. But they were a group of Nordic, you know, travellers, explorers, and they had gone and settled in Normandy in France, in the north of France there, and they'd been there for quite a few generations. So you're quite right. You mentioned actually the Norman conquest of England, and, you know, we're looking here at around the same time of William the Conqueror who goes across. In fact, our King Roger was loosely related to him, and, you know, they'll come, you know, back in around here. But Roger, let's just step back a bit. Roger.
I just love that we have King Roger.
I know, it's King Roger. Funny, I know. And there are a few Rogers in this story. Yeah. Roger was actually the son of another Roger, Roger de Hauteville. And Roger's father, Tancred, was a noble who lived in Normandy. He had, we know, at least 12 children and around 8 boys, all good, but only the eldest would inherit his father's titles and lands. So the others had to make their own way in the world. So Roger and his older brother Robert, who became known as Robert Guiscard, who was the foxy one, basically the sly one, became mercenaries, and they were particularly experienced at, you know, tactical sieges, naval battles. And they were actually in the south of Italy at the time when the Pope recruited them to reclaim Sicily in the name of Christendom. So essentially he promised them Sicily if they would just reconquer it and, you know, rid it of, you know, the Arabs and the Muslims who had been there now for 300 years. So Roger begins his assault on eastern Sicily in 1061, I think, and eventually reaches Palermo. It took him only 30 years to dominate the entire island, which, you know, really tells you how good he was at warfare.
Okay, so you would imagine perhaps when you think you get conquered by Vikings that it's not a particularly happy outcome, but they were actually fairly kind, decent rulers.
Yeah. Look, apart from the initial, you know, taking over and killing a lot of people, obviously, and they did their fair share of sieging, looting and pillaging, they became quite tolerant leaders. I mean, Roger and the Normans really proved willing to adapt to all the cultural traditions that had already existed in Sicily. And I think this was their greatest strength. You know, Roger, this first Roger, let's call him Count Roger as opposed to King Roger, basically outraged the Pope after the Pope had allowed him to take Sicily. In spite of the Pope's demands to rid the island of, you know, the Muslim religion and customs, Roger had no intention of displacing the talent that each cultural group had brought to Sicily. So, you know, he's absorbing the very cosmopolitan heritage of the Byzantines and the Arabs into his administration, into the architecture, the art, and also ceremonial rituals, and also keeping up diplomatic contacts across to the Middle East, to North Africa, to Greece, all of those places. So he was quite savvy. They were all quite savvy.
And Lauren, it's probably worth mentioning, I mean, and you mentioned Cordoba in Spain, and this was when the Moors, Arabs were controlling Spain, and that the Arab empires that sprung up had this incredible reputation for scholarship, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The universities they set up, the scholarship, and of course all of that scholarship, because the Arabs had ruled in Sicily for three centuries, had come to Sicily as well. So it was quite a learned, you know, part of the world, learned and cosmopolitan part of the world. And in being that, it also attracted then, I guess, money coming into Sicily, which helped the economy.
And so Roger, this is still Roger Senior, isn't it? Count Roger. Yeah. How did he set up the government then once he took over?
Well, you know, he made a few really good executive decisions. He decided on a very hybrid model of governing. He used a Byzantine style for his court protocol, an Arab style for his finance, and he used a lot of Muslim administrators. For his record keeping and his official documents, and this is beautiful, Suzanne, because we see this in the churches as well. The documents are actually drawn up in three different languages, Arabic, Latin, and Greek, which were all of the languages being spoken in Sicily at the time. So he's also aware that in order to really get the people on side, he's got to be able to communicate with the people. So, you know, he does so by using all three different languages.
And he allowed the mosques to stay.
Yeah. The Pope particularly hated this, right? Because he also wants to be tolerant to all the religions that are already there. So he's allowing everyone to, you know, I mean, some of the mosques went because they became Christianized churches, but he did allow a lot of them to stay.
Did the Pope say, well, hang on, you're not the best person to be running Sicily because you're not pushing the Muslims out?
Yeah, but, you know, Roger had a pretty big army. And the Pope, I think, you know, had a good think about it because he may have needed Roger's mercenaries in his armies, which now included also Muslim soldiers, Muslim recruits. He may have needed them at some stage to, you know, conquer another part of Italy. Because if you, you know, if you think about the history at this period of time, Italy is not a consolidated Italy. There is no actual political entity known as Italy at the time. There's Sicily, there's the Calabria, there's the, you know, the Papal States, there's the territory of Florence, of Tuscany. So they're all separate territories and the Pope hopes to win back a lot of them and consolidate them.
Now, Roger, Count Roger, died in 1101 and that meant that Roger Jr. Got to take over, right?
Yeah. And this was King Roger, Rogerius Rex. And he was crowned in around 1130, I think. And during his reign, he was the wealthiest ruler in Europe and his court in Palermo was the most opulent. It was sort of an artistic golden age
So with all that money, there would have been lots of investment. So what did the Normans leave as a legacy in Sicily?
Okay. So, you know, keeping in line with this idea of, you know, Christianizing Sicily and Palermo, they went on, a church building campaign and probably the primary Norman cultural heritage that they leave us is that the building of churches and palaces, like I'm going to mention the Palazzo dei Normanni, the Norman Palace in Palermo, which is in its grandeur, you know, something that they'd never seen before. But what he was actually doing was he was transforming the emir's fortress. There was already a fortress there. And recent exploration has actually shown that the Arabs had previously consolidated and enlarged a Phoenician fortress that was on this spot. So it was obviously a very, you know, good position in the city in Palermo. And the Normans decided to build their palace there. And it is incredible. One of the gems of it is the King Roger's room, the Sala di Re Ruggero. And it's one of the most magnificent rooms designed, it's said, by Roger himself. And the mosaics, I'm pretty sure, Suzanne, the mosaics are some of the few and possibly the only surviving secular mosaics in Europe during this period. So they depict, you know, centaurs, birds, palm trees, landscapes with, you know, lions and leopards roaming through them, peacocks, you know, and all of them with some sort of symbolic significance. For example, peacocks are symbols of immortality and resurrection. Mm-hmm. There was a belief, an ancient belief, that a peacock's flesh never decayed. So, you know, it became sort of caught up in that very Christian idea of resurrection and immortality. But the true gem of the Palazzo dei Normanni was the Palatine Chapel, the Cappella Palatina. And this was basically the church space in there, but it was the royal church. And as a monument to royalty, to Norman royalty, it is a mosaic-studded jewel commissioned by Roger and completed, you know, in 10 years. The mosaics there, Suzanne, and I would recommend for anyone going to Sicily to go and see this space, are the work of Greek Byzantine craftsmen, and it glitters. Mm. The surface glitters. It's almost as though there is no surface left untouched by golden mosaics. And when you think about the way mosaics are structured, mosaics are actually, you know, you've got the grand mosaics like the Romans did. You know, you can walk into a Roman villa and still see the beautiful floor mosaics that are stone and very smooth because, you know, you've got to walk across it and you can't have your feet cut. But when you do wall mosaics, the little tesserae, the little pieces are actually made of glass, and each tesserae has a little piece of gold in it, real gold, as well as colour. And then the master craftsman puts them on the wall slightly at an angle to each other so that when the light refracts from them, and think candlelight because there's no electricity, so when all of the candles are lit in this chapel or in one of the churches, the light bounces off all of this uneven surface and glitters, and the figures, whichever way you turn, seem to come alive. Mm. So it feels as though you are actually in heaven, in paradise, in standing in this space.
Mm. So what are some of these? This isn't a secular room, though, is it, the Palatine Chapel?
No. This is a church space. So it's basically, a lot of the mosaics recount tales from the Old and New Testaments. There's a particular emphasis, I think, on themes relating to the Holy Spirit and this theology of light. In the central apse, you know, above the altar, there is the most beautiful mosaic of Christ Pantocrator, or Christ Almighty, all powerful. And he bears the message written, interestingly, in both Latin and Greek, that says, "I am the light of the world." So, you know, it's this idea that Christ is always looking over us, providing the light, but always present as well. And the ceiling, actually, the ceiling is, I think, something that doesn't exist in any other place except in Sicily. It's a form of ceiling that was made by North African workmanship. It's called Fatimid workmanship, and they use these things called mukarnas. Mukarnas are sort of, you know, carved and painted cedar wood, and it's almost like a three-dimensional decoration, almost like a honeycomb ceiling, if you can imagine, in three dimensions, that seems to form like, you know, icicles coming down from the ceiling in beautiful wood. And in the side aisles, there's more wood and beautiful images, you know, paintings of musicians and dancing girls and, you know, and houris, which are beautiful women, essentially, represented in Muslim, you know, religion. And also, you know, there's banquets at courts with servants pouring wine. So you get sort of the secular, you know, atmosphere there on the side aisles. It's interesting that later, you know, ecclesiastical authorities actually added halos to these figures to make it look a bit more, you know, religious.
So is this too the Palatine Chapel built on what had been what formerly a Muslim area?
Yeah. The whole Palace dei Normanni was the emir's fortress, and it was the major road in Palermo, on the major road. The road now is the Corso Vittorio Emanuele. And it was known at the time when the Normans came in as the Casaro, which is the major town. And the part of it was actually paved in marble because you could walk in the time of the Muslim rulers, the Arabs, you could walk from the fortress to the mosque. And then the Normans came along, changed it to the palace, and the mosque was changed into the Cathedral of Palermo. So you could still walk across that beautiful marbled area on the Casaro, on the main drag, from the palace to the Cathedral of Palermo.
You're on Nightlife. We've got Dr. Lorraine Kipiotis here from the National Art School. We're talking about the Vikings in Sicily, particularly some of the stunning mosaics and architectural features that they left behind. I wonder if you've been to Sicily and see any of these. If you have, you'll probably be having memories of just how beautiful some of the artworks are in Palermo in particular. All right, now then there's La Martorana. Lorraine, tell us about this.
Yeah. I wanted to mention La Martorana. Its other name is Santa Maria del Ammiraglio. Ammiraglio means the admiral, and it was a church that was basically built by Roger's admiral, who had helped him in, you know, a lot of these battles. But it's the church where, you know, when you go in, there's a beautiful mosaic there. And if there's any doubt that the Normans presumed themselves to have a divinely ordained right to rule Sicily, this particular mosaic blows that out of the water, because there is a beautiful mosaic of Rogerius Rex, wearing this incredible Byzantine gown, because that's how he had himself represented in these images, wearing Byzantine dress, even though he was a Norman. The Normans are really good at adapting to the, you know, the local customs. And above him, in I think it's in Greek letters, reads Rogerius Rex, the king. Now, here's the rub. He's being crowned not by angels or by another saint, but he's being crowned directly by Christ himself, who places a pearl-encrusted gold crown on Roger's head. And, you know, this is usually only reserved imagery, only usually reserved for the Pope or really high church officials in Western art. So, again, the Pope's not happy, you know, about this. But, you know, this truly shows him as the ruler that he is.
He really let Roger off the leash, didn't he? When he let them take over Sicily.
Yeah.
Okay, so Lorraine, what happened when Roger died?
Okay, well, he's obviously got a son, and his son is named William, and William the First gained the reputation. He was called William the Bad, sadly, because his son, who we'll talk about in a second, was named William the Good, so they had to differentiate the two Williams. And William the Bad, look, he never expected to rule. He did lose a lot of the land gains that his father had made, but he never thought he'd have to rule the kingdom, so he was a little dissolute. He had three older brothers, all who we thought would rule. Okay, there was Roger the Third, died an unknown death. Tancred the Second died at age 18, and Alfonso died in battle, age 24. So all of a sudden, William, who's the fourth boy, has to rule the kingdom. So
and that explains why it wasn't more Rogers who took the throne.
That's right.
It could have been a glorious line
of Rogers. That's right. Yeah. Release the Rogers.
Okay, but
Sicily.
William didn't last terribly long either. He died at 40.
That's right. And it luckily for Sicily, because then William the Good takes over, William the Second. Now, this is where we link back in to William the Conqueror over in England, because William the Second marries Joan Plantagenet, who is the daughter of Henry the Second of England and Eleanor Aquitaine. She is sister to Richard the Lionheart and King John, and she's the great-great-granddaughter of William the Conqueror. So the English Normans and the Sicilian Normans are reunited in this marriage.
Oh, wow.
You know.
Now, William the Good, I think, was responsible for the Cathedral of Monreal. And I'm thinking of my memories of going to Sicily. I think this was the one that blew me away the most.
So William, not to be outdone by his grandfather, Roger, wants to build a cathedral bigger and better than, you know, the Cappella Palatina in the Palazzo dei Normanni. So he builds the cathedral in Monreal, and you're right, this is the cathedral that will really blow your mind if you go to Sicily. He has wealth, untold wealth, and it takes him only 9 years to build this. Now, when you think, Suzanne, that it took hundreds of years to build Gothic cathedrals that are being built at the same time in the north of Europe, and it takes him only 9 years to build this with around 1,800 kilograms of pure gold in the mosaics, and hundreds of the finest craftsmen brought across from Constantinople and employed at great expense to work really quickly. The mosaics actually cover 7,600 square meters. Wow. Now, I know that doesn't mean a lot when you're just talking about that, but in comparison, the Sistine Chapel has just over 1,000 square meters of paintings in it. And these mosaics are 7,600 square meters.
So seven times as big, roughly.
Yeah, big. That's right. And again, you know, the scenes are Bible scenes, early Christian saints. And it's all about, there's a plethora also of sort of Old Testament leaders, princes, kings, who suggest that William's leadership is on a par with theirs. Mm. So it's all about his kingship and his place as well.
Mm. Now, there's an unusual wedding gift in the church.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is actually, well, I'm not sure I would have liked to have had this wedding gift, but under the high altar, apparently the remains of Saint Castrense, who was a fifth century bishop of Carthage, and he was sentenced to death by the king of the Vandals at one stage, and he was placed on a boat full of holes and sent out to sea in a storm. He survived, miraculously. The boat touched down in Naples and, you know, he took up life as a hermit and eventually died, and his body was, you know, consecrated as a saint's body. His intact body was given to William II and his bride, Joan of England, on their wedding day and, of course, duly placed under the high altar. And I can only imagine, well, thanks very much for the body of Saint Castrense. We're just going to put it over here. Underneath
well,
the altar.
I mean, maybe in those days, getting a body of a saint really was a big deal.
Yeah, look, I'm sure because really, how many would there been around?
Yeah, I mean, if he's legit, I think that's not so bad. Still there though, the body of Saint Castrense.
Yes, yeah, yes, yes, yes.
So, what else can you tell us about the interior of the cathedral?
Okay, well, like Roger, the image of Rogerius Rex being crowned by Christ, William decides he's going to do the same thing. So he's dressed in royal regalia, you know, very much reminiscent of a Byzantine emperor, just like Roger. And just like Roger, he's being crowned by Christ. And it's almost as though the two images could be put side by side and they're almost identical, except for their faces. Because, Suzanne, the mosaics were actually made by people who knew Roger and who knew William and knew what they looked like. So they are individuals in these two images. And you can see, you know, Roger has quite a lovely long face and long hair and, you know, beard, and William has a far more rounded face. So you can see that they are actually individualized mosaics.
So what happened after William II? Did he have kids?
Gosh, you know, this is a little bit where it starts sounding a bit like Game of Thrones here. And, you know, you can see where George R. you know, R. Martin got all his inspiration. William and Joan did not have children. And realizing that there'd be no one in the direct bloodline to take the crown, he drags his aunt Constance, his auntie Constance, and she's the daughter of Roger II, okay?
Mm-hmm.
His auntie, sister to his, you know, father William. Mm. She's the last Norman princess. He drags her out of a convent at age 32 and forces her to marry Henry VI of Swabia, who is the Holy Roman Emperor.
Oh.
Because he's now trying to consolidate the entire Holy Roman Empire, not only the Empire of Sicily, the kingship of Sicily. So Constance actually has a son at age 40 and she rules as regent because by this time William's died. She rules as regent up until about the time he's 3. And then this kid, this poor kid, Frederick, is basically allowed to roam the streets of Palermo wild. I mean, he's still living in the palace and still being looked after by, you know, minions, whatever. And in fact, his guardian is actually the Pope, right? So the Pope's responsible for him. But he's allowed to roam the streets of Palermo. And in doing so, he really gets to know the people. He also learns all of the languages, you know, that are out there extant in around the streets of Sicily. And he becomes one of the most respected and esteemed rulers. He is crowned Frederick II of Hohenstaufen, Holy Roman Emperor and King of Sicily. The Pope at this stage is really starting to, you know, perhaps feel a little frightened because he's got this guy who is ruling not only from the south of him in Sicily, but also has dominion of all of the lands north of him because the Holy Roman Emperor was ruling from that area, you know, sort of in South Germany, that area up there. So the Pope's got here Frederick on both sides of him. So he's, you know, treading carefully. But Frederick, a little bit like his great-grandfather Roger, is munificent and magnificent, and he's known as the Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world. And he enjoys this reputation as a brilliant and a learned scholar, a visionary statesman, an inspired naturalist, a mathematician. It goes on and on and on and on.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And he speaks about 6 languages. Incredible. Now, here's the rub. And sadly, and very, very sadly, the whole dynasty comes to an end with his grandson, Conrad II. There was Conrad I, who died again early. And Conrad II, who sadly was killed at age 16.
Oh, gosh.
By, you know, others who wanted to take over the kingship of Sicily.
Right. And so this whole period that the Normans in Sicily, what it lasted about 5 generations
and then literally, you know, just over a century, I think, five generations, it bought, it made, I think it really formed Sicily to what it is today. And, you know, as you've mentioned, Suzanne, you can go to Palermo today and still see these incredible churches and the legacy that the Vikings left us in Sicily.
And who would have expected the Vikings would have left us such beauty? But they did.
But they did.
Yeah. Lorraine, what a wonderful story. Thank you so much for coming into Nightlife to tell us.
Thanks, Suzanne.
There's Dr. Lorraine Kipiotis from the National Art School.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.